Good morning. The state Civil Rights Commission doesn't want it here. The commission is calling for solidarity among the people of Hawaii in standing against the reported rise of discriminatory harassment and intimidation. We'll talk with Commission Chair Linda Hamilton Krieger. Composting may sound like it's a great idea unless it's a proposed composting facility on Hawaii Island. Bobby Yamada of the Kekaha Paneva Farmers Association tells us why. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. When singers and actors audition, all the years of training and practice are compressed into a few minutes, and you'd better be ready. It's a world that actor, director, and composer John Rubenstein knows well. And in our studio with this big wave surfer Ian Walsh, the subject of the new movie Distance Between Dreams.
That's the conversation for this Friday, December 2nd. We'll start after the news. Good morning and welcome to the conversation for this Friday, and Aloha Friday, kind of windy, kind of rainy,
yeah,
kind of seasonal, or at least as seasonal as we're
going
to get.
Kind of winter coming on.
At least for us. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning. You know, at first blush, you would think that a composting facility would be welcomed by all, but not necessarily.
Well, yeah, and that's what interested us about this story, too. Because, you know, with the growing ethos of a green economy, few people might argue against composting. Unless it's a large facility on Hawaii Island. The opposition isn't only to the facility, but part of the plan that would process more than just green waste. The Keokaha Paneva Farmers Association has written a letter, which will be presented to its board tomorrow for a vote. And the plan is to send it on to site design company PBR Hawaii and to Big Island Mayor Harry Kim on Monday. The association wants a complete environmental impact statement, saying the already produced environmental assessment is incomplete. Bobby Yamada is a spokesperson for the Keokaha Paneva Farmers Association. He's on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for making time for us today. You know, it's in one way, as we began to talk about in the opening, a little strange that something that is doing something that on the face of it looks good for the environment might be something that would meet such resistance. But aside from the green waste part of it, which you seem to be okay with, what specifically bothers you about the environmental assessment that's been done to date?
It has not adequately addressed the concerns of the community, especially when this facility is also going to introduce food waste. We have no objection if only green waste is process through the facility, but because they're adding in food waste, that adds a little bit more to the equation on whether or not this facility is going to be safe and odor-free and environmental-free as far as its impact on the water table that's down below the entire Paneva area, because this is where the Department of Water Supply has their major water wells in Paneva. That's about a mile away. That feeds most of Hilo, so it's protection of that water source also that we're concerned about.
Bobby, when you talk about food waste,
yes.
You know, food waste covers so many types of things that we throw out. What specifically do you mean? Are you talking about things that would be coming from fruit and vegetables, or fruit and vegetables plus dairy, fruit and vegetables plus dairy plus maybe meat products? I mean, how much of this are you talking about?
The county and the contractor have not specifically defined what is food waste. So we just have to assume that it's the whole gamut of whatever food that goes through the mainstream, and whatever is left over that normally would be wasted at the landfill is what's going to be processed through this compost facility. And that would include all the leftover foods from hotels and whatnot that's normally disposed of in the landfill that would now be routed through this compost facility. And we're concerned about the odor that will be generated by the food waste.
There are ways of being able to offset that, depending upon, you know, how, what kind of food waste you're talking about. We've had lots of conversations about, you know, people who are doing it at home with a Bokashi bucket, and they put it in there, it's sealed up, and yes, it may smell when you're digging your hole and burying it, and then 2 weeks later you have soil. But when you're talking about a facility as large as is being proposed, is there any sense that your those who are proponents of this composting facility understand your concerns about the kind of wet food waste that would lead to some pretty odoriferous wafting of smells?
Well, they're saying that in the beginning, this facility is going to process about 70 tons of waste per day. And once the facility gets running, that'll ramp up to about 100 tons a day. Now, what percent of that is actually food waste, I'm not sure, but whatever food waste is in there, part of the process is to mitigate the smell and bacteria and whatnot that may get out. But we're concerned about what happens if there's an emergency, a power failure, or an earthquake, or a hurricane that does something to the facility where it takes it offline, and we have all of this different food waste that's either stockpiled to be processed or already in the process that breaks free into the environment. What happens then? And our community, who are, you know, 500 to 1,000 feet away from the facility, they're the ones that are going to be directly impacted by any type of odor or smell or bacteria that's emitted into the air. And that's what we're concerned about. How is the county or the contractor going to address situations like that? And they have not adequately answered those concerns to us.
It's a lot more than just cosmetics, clearly, from what we're hearing from you, and the fact that this wasn't addressed in the present environmental assessment. At this point, is there still time for people in the community to make comments and to be able to weigh in on this?
Yes. The actual comment period expired, but we've been assured by the county that they're going to extend that to December 12th. So if other members of the community want to provide comments, they have until that date, and they can send it in. I would say, because it's last minute, that we they're sending in directly to the mayor, the new mayor, Mayor Harry Kim.
Have you had any discussions with him about this, I mean, even before he became mayor?
No, we've not. We've had discussions with Billy Kino and his administration, but we realize that they're on their way out, so it's not going to be a high-priority item with them, and they're going to what it seems to us, they're just going to hand it off to Mayor Harry Kim's administration to deal with. So we have a scheduled appointment with Mayor Harry Kim the week after next on Monday.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We'll be watching this.
Thank you.
Bobby Yamada is the Keokaha Paneewa Farmers Association treasurer and spokesperson. And as he mentioned, if anyone in the community wants to make comment about the composting facility, you have until December 12th to do it.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:15, almost. Coming up in the show, the art and science of putting your best foot forward after your quiz.
Unihoa, kai ula nai o mau o ka ho olawe o hawai.
And now for something a little less serious than what we've been hearing about today with so much rain and what could happen with a composting facility on the Big Island. Now, in today's backyard quiz, we're taking flight. With the upcoming holiday season, many of you may be planning some form of air travel to visit family on another island or perhaps on the mainland. That kind of trip may seem routine in modern life in Hawaii, but decades ago, travel by plane was not so common. Although planes have been landing in Hawaii since the early 20th century, it wasn't until many decades later that air travel became fast, comfortable, and affordable. That slow evolution began in the 1930s when the first commercial flight came to Hawaii. For today's quiz, can you name on which airline those lucky passengers flew and the precise destination of the first commercial flight? If you know, you can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Hawaii Public Radio 的节目 The Conversation。
Aspiring performing artists soon learn as they pound the pavement in search of a job that auditioning is an art in itself. Skills that have taken you years to acquire must be distilled down to a very few minutes when you're at your absolute best. Easier said than done, but experienced performers know what to do, which makes workshops like the ones that John Rubenstein will be offering this week so valuable. John is a Tony Award-winning actor with more than 50 years of performing experience, who's also a seasoned director and composer. He's with us in our studio. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
You were doing shows from pretty early on, weren't you?
Yes. I went to a grade school in, pardon me, in New York City called St. Bernard's, which was run by British folks and based on their kind of school system. And you graduated in eighth grade. It didn't go beyond eighth grade. Which is why I ended up going to collegiate for high school, which is where you went.
Yep.
And so we're old schoolmates. But they took their public speaking and their dramatics very, very seriously at that little grade school. The eighth grade produced and acted in a Shakespeare play every year. And they were all boys. So the boys played all the women's parts. Just as in Shakespeare's time. And the teachers were these Brits who knew their stuff. The director was an old doily cart, Gilbert and Sullivan man. And so by the time I got out of eighth grade, I had done a lot of plays. I had done three Shakespeare plays because I was in the eighth grade play when I was in sixth and seventh grades because they needed extra people. And we, when you were in seventh grade, you had your director as your homeroom teacher.
Wow.
And you learned the play that you would be doing next year in your eighth grade year all year long. The whole class read the play again and again and again and again. We were told and we had tests on all Elizabethan drama, on the other great playwrights of the time, on all of the weird references that Shakespeare makes in mythology and in the Bible,
which are
sexual
many.
References. We were explained all those things. So that even though when we were 13, we were performing these plays, we knew what we were talking about. And he also taught us stagecraft. So, yes, I you know, was on the stage all my life, really.
Well, by the time you were in high school, and this is a personal memory for me as somebody who was a couple years behind you in school, you were doing these great shows that we would see at assembly. You and a couple of your classmates would write these, you know, what to me looked like fully formed musicals.
Well, we did. We wrote the music and we wrote the lyrics. That's where I started writing music, was there at Collegiate for those skits. They were sort of satirical skits. I fell in love with Julius Monk, who was a great writer of satirical musical reviews in New York. He had a permanent spot at the Plaza Hotel in a little theater downstairs, which now is a restaurant, but used to be a little theater. And I used to go and see those shows a great deal. And so sort of imitating that style, my friend Jack Anthony and I would write these reviews making fun of the teachers, making fun of, you know, CRA. You mm-hmm. would be the only person who knows what I mean by that.
Children running around.
Right. Collegiate recreational activities.
Yes.
Yeah.
We'd all toddle over to Central Park and run around in the great big oval there and play soccer.
That's exactly right. And we got the dean of boys, Hugh Silk, British gentleman too at Collegiate, who was very distinguished. And we got him to take a pie in the face, big cream pie, and do all kinds of other antics.
So, I remember him well.
Yes.
Claude Hugh Percival Silk.
That's exactly right.
Well, when you got out into the cold, cruel world, just down the road on Broadway, had a lot of the fear, the anxiety gone out of you with all that experience? Were you better able to, still as frightening as
I
one would expect?
I carry the fear and anxiety with me still today, Because, you know, it's a very daunting thing to present yourself for a job. I think everybody does that in every profession. The job interview, the way you get hired, you are judged by your resume, by what you've done before, by how you walk in the room, by the particular mood of the person interviewing you, whoever that may be, for whatever the job is.
Sure.
In the theater, it's very much the same, except it might just be a little bit more personal because you are presenting yourself, your body, the way it looks, your voice, the way it sounds, you know, your sexiness or lack of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it can get very, very close to the skeleton.
It calls for a very candid appraisal of yourself, right?
Right. And then on top of that, whatever skills you've developed and need to show off. Mm-hmm. And there's always that feeling of there's a line around the block of people waiting to do the job if they don't hire you. So the competitiveness is ferocious.
All that, you know, all that fear, anxiety can be translated into energy. I mean, it's a form of energy, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was doing a seminar yesterday at the university, and one of the students asked me about, what do you do about your nerves? And I say, well, you know, one of the things is you can channel that into just enjoying performing, because that's really what you're doing anyway. Mm-hmm. That's why you want that job, is because you love to work, you love to act, you love to perform. So an audition is a performance.
Sure.
It happens to also be an attempt to be hired, which is something you want because you need to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. But still, it is a performance, and you can just walk into that room and do your thing and then leave that room, and you have done something. Now, if it leads to a job, great. If it doesn't, too bad. But you still have that. So if you think of your audition less as a trial that you might fail, you know, or win.
Which doesn't do you any good.
Think of it as just a fun thing to get to do that day. Play that little part for 5 minutes and sing that song or do whatever it is.
Be reminded that this is what you love.
Exactly.
That's the thing to hang on to, isn't it?
Yeah. And then the other thing is, you know, and I said this also in my seminar yesterday, you go in as an auditioner and you have this, so many actors do, this peculiar mindset, they hate me. They're going to hate me. They're going to see that I have no talent, and they're going to laugh and kick me out of here.
Yeah.
And I got to somehow try to overcome that.
Uh-huh.
And the absolute opposite is the case. The people sitting behind the table watching your audition, who have a job for you perhaps, they love you. They want you to be good. They're rooting for you like only your mother might root for you.
That's right.
You know, and and if you don't measure up, they're disappointed.
Sure, sure. Good stuff, good to keep in mind no matter what your field of endeavor,
That's
isn't
right.
it, John?
Yeah.
It really is. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
great to see you again.
Yeah,
and
to see you again.
All these years. Tony Award-winning actor John Rubenstein will hold a master class on Monday from 6 to 7:30 p.m. in Seto Hall on the campus of Iolani School, and that class is free and open to the public. You can learn about John's other events on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hawaii Public Radio is grateful for the support of our listeners and for our many community partners, including the League of Women Voters, Hawaiian Tel, and Temple Emmanuel. Thank you all for your generosity and participation during our recent on-air campaign.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
In the December Dakota winter, Standing Rock protesters are getting a warm aloha from Hawaii activists. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the ongoing reality check for us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So practically since this got started, this seemed to call to people from different places around the world, different indigenous peoples who were looking to make a stand there with the Standing Rock Sioux. And that included folks from Hawaii. They've kind of been coming and going. We've been talking about this now for a couple of months. It's winter, though. I mean, it's a pretty cruel winter from the pictures that we're seeing, you know, on the website, on the Civil Beat website, where you've sent a photographer. How many of Hawaii residents are there now, and what did they have to do to give up and go there? Did some of them actually, you know, disconnect from their jobs?
Well, I should tell you that we actually sent not only our photographer, Corey Love, but also our reporter, Nick Ruby. They are there on the ground in North Dakota, where today, last time I checked, it was 26 degrees and cloudy, and you can see from Corey's photos that it's a pretty stark situation, weather settling in there. But we felt it was important enough because, absolutely, there's a number of Native Hawaiians, and so there are real ties between what the Sioux and other Native Americans, there's even Maori there, a sense of solidarity, take a stand. And in this case, of course, it's to oppose that pipeline, the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline, that the Sioux and others say, look, this is threatening not only our water, but our very way of life. So for Hawaiians, they see direct parallels. As you know, water is life. Life is water. It's sacred. So that's why they're there helping the Sioux.
You have people, though, who are not Native Hawaiians, others who have
Correct.
Just felt the call to be there. Do we know who some of these people are?
Yeah, there's a person from Maui. She's white. She quit her job. She felt it was important enough to come and be here. There's also folks like Andre Perez, a Native Hawaiian, fairly well-known activist in the local community. He's gone up there a couple of times. He's actually helping to instruct some of the protesters on how to be nonviolent because, as you know, there's been a lot of demonstrations going on there. Nick describes the scene as rather tense. People are paranoid, worried about infiltrators. Just recently, both the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer and the North Dakota governor have issued an eviction notice for Monday. Whether they're actually going to follow through on that remains to be seen, but people are on edge right now.
And we understand that Representative Tulsi Gabbard is going to be there over the weekend.
Yeah, this is a really remarkable event. 2,000 veterans are going to be there. They are going to serve as human shields between the protesters and the people trying to build the pipeline. Gabbard actually went to the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives this week and demanded that President Obama kill this pipeline project. She just thinks it's highly unconscionable that it's going up and threatening the very survival of the Standing Rock Sioux.
Well, we're going to be watching this weekend. Tense doesn't quite begin to describe it. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
In Hawaii, especially next week, we have a very important commemoration. Bill Dorman, our news director, is coming in to tell us a little bit about what our plans are for covering the Pearl Harbor anniversary. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You know, such a huge, not only day in terms of the commemoration of the 75th anniversary, but an opportunity really for storytelling. From we hear a lot about Pearl Harbor as a military story, and certainly that's a huge, obviously, part of it. But the civilian story here on Hawaii is something that sometimes gets less attention. We've been fortunate over the past several weeks and a couple of months, actually, to be gathering some voices from folks who at the time were young, were here on Oahu that morning and have memories not just of that day of the attack and what happened to them and their families and their situations, but also what that introduced in terms of changing life in Hawaii and for them and on so many levels. I mean, obviously for the United States, it was going into the war and that changed everything. But also in Hawaii, hearing stories about how, you know, the insular nature of a lot of pre-war Hawaii was gone, not just with servicemen coming in to Hawaii, but also a lot of folks from Hawaii going out and then coming back after the war and shifts and changes on that. So a lot of this, again, is stories in the words of the people who lived them.
And how that sweet bubble was really burst in so many ways, attitudinally, experientially, so many things that if we don't capture those stories very quickly, we might not have them. So glad to hear you'll be doing that.
And there are parts also in terms of the, sometimes people don't realize pulling the lens back in terms of before we got to December 7th itself, some of the background of the military presence here on Oahu and the buildup of that over time, and also culturally, a lot of the demographic story at the time, you know, Hawaii itself, about 40% ethnically Japanese at the time, a lot of complications on that before the bombing of Pearl Harbor and in the time after as well. Noe Tainagawa in particular has a series of pieces that she's doing looking at some of those aspects as well.
And some of how the population shifted here, too, ever after. We talked to a lot of people who say, oh, yes, my grandparents came during the war or before the war and decided they were going to settle in Hawaii. We hear that story a lot, too, so how it changed so many of us and life for so many of us.
It's true. A lot of strands to the story, and we'll get just some of them next week.
Good. Well, thanks. We're looking forward to that, and we'll be talking about that on The Conversation, too. So we hope you'll plan to join all of us next week. Thanks very much to Bill Dorman, HPR's news director.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Hawaii Pacific University and Ulupono Initiative.
With mainland reports of discriminatory harassment and intimidation, the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission is hoping to head off any similar incidents here. This week, it issued a call for solidarity among Hawaii residents to stand up for the shared Hawaii values based in the diversity the state represents. But as we heard earlier in the week from contributing editor Neil Milner, those with deep-seated and simmering resentments may now feel they have license to act on them. Hawaii Civil Rights Commission Chair Linda Hamilton Krieger joins us now. Good morning. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So far, we've been fairly lucky not to hear of the kinds of incidents that we're hearing about on the mainland actually happening here in Hawaii. And when you send out this release asking people to focus on the better part of our nature and the things that bind us, it seemed to be a reminder that, as with so many other things that we've said, you know, it can't happen or it won't happen in Hawaii, we in fact could see this happen here. What made you want to send this out now?
Well, I think it's important for everyone to remember that managing our diversity is a constant task that we have to attend to. We have to work on it, right? Human beings tend to divide themselves into groups and develop tensions among and between groups. And if we want to preserve the values that we cherish, we have to work on that constantly. So it's just a reminder to everyone to respect each other, to expect respect from each other, and to speak out if you see that ethic of respect not being followed.
It also seemed to be, at least subtly, a reminder that we could see some of the things that we cherish in Hawaii, that we want to protect in Hawaii, potentially threatened by policy changes in the future, and looking to people in the state and of the state to take up those causes, whether it's, you know, environmental or issues of discrimination, civil rights.
I think this is very important. We have, at least in the last 8 years, become quite reliant on federal agencies and federal programs to help us enforce laws and norms around civil rights in Hawaii. So, for example, the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission gets most of its funding to enforce fair housing laws from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. We rely on the EEOC. We rely on the Department of Education to enforce Title IX. Those federal agencies are likely to behave very differently under a Trump administration than they have under the Obama administration, and they're likely to be losing funding. So I think we're going to have to step up at the state government level to become more self-reliant in enforcing some of those laws and norms. We have no state law equivalent to Title IX, which deals with sex discrimination in education and other government-funded programs. We have no state equivalent to Title VI, which is the same for race and racialized national origin. We are going to have to really look at the balance of how we've been relying on the federal government and what we need to do ourselves. That's going to mean some changes in priority in terms of funding, not just in the civil rights area, but in social services across the board.
You mentioned Title IX. I mean, some people will think, well, you know, that's incredibly ironic given the fact that Patsy Mink was the one that pushed that through.
Yes.
And in our own state, we have no equivalent, perhaps because it was thought to be unnecessary at that point. But as we know with policy, policy is only in effect until it isn't. And then at that point, you know, changes have to be responded to if, in fact, they take away what a lot of people have grown up believing was, you know, simply there and would always be there. And we see that happening in lots of different ways. But how do you see this playing out as we're coming into this next legislative session where there's so much uncertainty with an administration that has yet to begin and yet trying to head off some of the things that you've just talked about where funding could be threatened?
Yeah, I imagine that it's going to take at least a year to see how some of this works itself out at the federal level, and that the next legislative session will be more of a time of reckoning than this one. I think we have to look, we have to watch, we have to be mindful, we have to see what happens before we make state
that
policy.
Also, though, seems to suggest that this legislative session, 2017, needs to be one of great thought and preparation and looking at potential scenarios and what those consequences might mean and start to make some preparations so we're not caught.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things we're looking at doing at the Civil Rights Commission is to issue more regulations interpreting our own civil rights laws here in Hawaii. We've been relying a great deal on interpretations by the federal government. And if we want to preserve the values that that we hold dear, we're going to have to do that regulation ourselves. So at the Civil Rights Commission, we're going to be very busy doing that in the next year.
That sounds a little bit like leading by example and asking others to follow suit.
That's fair.
At this point, because we don't know simply what we don't know, and there's so many things that we could conjecture, is there a particular way of approaching how we go through this uncertainty together and not just calling for people to be calm and to be civil and to be concerned about the levels of diversity that we have and what Hawaii has done to protect that diversity, but some real action items that people would take more specific than some of the generic things that came across in the press release?
Sure. And here I need to speak as a private citizen rather than as chair of the Civil Rights Commission. I think it is going to be extremely important to actively and visibly resist many of the things that we're likely to see coming out of this administration. And when I say that, I mean protest, I mean speech, I mean direct action. But again, this is, I'm speaking in my role as a private individual in that respect. Speech, hate speech has to be met with resistance or it becomes normalized. And I think it's incumbent on every citizen to call out what they see as being a drift towards race baiting, gender baiting, foreigner baiting, anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim sentiment, misogyny. We have to speak up.
When we heard from Neil Milner earlier in the week, and he was saying that, you know, in the most recent years that all of this became underground because people didn't feel comfortable to be able to talk about it. They didn't have the license to do that, but that it wasn't, you know, a sign that it wasn't there simply because we didn't hear about it. But now your point, and your point well taken, is that as it begins to bubble up, there needs to be
equal talk about why
it's not appropriate.
Sure, and don't get me wrong. I think there is a lot of discrimination in Hawaii, and there is a lot of discrimination in the United States. It has been largely sort of under the surface for many people, not for everyone. And in some ways, I think this is seeing these voices emerging is instructive. It helps us remember that we are not in a post-racial society. We are not in a post-gender society. These are struggles that have to be fought and refought or we lose ground.
It's a real reminder of who the we really is and that the we isn't with a capital W. Thanks very much for coming in. We'll be talking more.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Linda Hamilton Krieger is the chair of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission.
Mele Kaliki Maka and happy holidays. This is Ian O'Sullivan. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. In 1839, missionary Amos Starr Cook received a letter from chiefs on Oahu asking him to teach their children wisdom and righteousness. Among these students were Bernice Pauahi Bishop, Alexander Liholiho, and the future queens Emma and Liliuokalani. With the teachings of the Cooks as their foundation, these ali'i established Kamehameha Schools, the Queen's Hospital, and the Queen Liliuokalani Trust for Orphaned and Indigent Hawaiian Children. The Cooks taught their own children the same principles, including the precept of charitable giving to the people of Hawaii. The Cooks' daughter, Juliet Montague Cook Atherton, began a charitable trust in 1915 and had her children continue the work. During their many years, they've supported endeavors too numerous to mention here. And recently, though, they helped fund the Polynesian Voyaging Society's worldwide cruise. Continuing the legacy of helping Hawaii Nei is a primary focus that still drives the Atherton Family Foundation's grant-making today. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you which airline flew the first commercial route to Hawaii and where in Hawaii that flight landed. It may surprise you to learn that commercial flight to Hawaii became available to the general public in 1935. It was a 16-hour flight from Los Angeles, staggering by today's standards. The route now takes about 5 hours. In 1935, the cost of a flight to Hawaii was also overwhelming for most people, about $500. That's about $9,000 in today's dollars. Those early flights were accomplished using the venerable Martin M-130 flying boat. The M-130's ability to land on water made it ideal for reaching remote Pacific islands without large, well-maintained airfields. And that's exactly what Pan American Airlines did on its multi-layover route from San Francisco to Manila, including a refueling stop on Honolulu's Ke'ehi Lagoon, the second half of today's answer. The deep channels carved into the reef for the flying boats at Kahi Lagoon can still be seen today. And nobody got that, but all the more reason to try again on Monday's backyard quiz. But that's today's quiz at 8:47. And if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Big wave surfing is about constantly pushing the envelope, harnessing the almost unimaginable power of the ocean at its most ferocious. It's a world that calls for single-minded dedication and complete concentration. It's the subject of a new film about Ian Walsh and his daredevil friends. The movie is Distance Between Dreams. It has its Oahu premiere tonight, and Ian is with us in our studio. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What's the difference between a surfer and a big wave surfer? What kind of transition do you have to make? Did you have to make when you went after the biggest waves?
Well, essentially, it's the same thing. A surfer is still a big wave surfer, and a big wave surfer is still a surfer. But the biggest difference is just, you know, putting in a lot of time in the ocean and having a really good understanding of your surroundings and spending a lifetime surfing. You kind of build a threshold of how the ocean works and you can inch your way up into bigger and bigger surf. And after a life here in Hawaii, that's what I feel like pushes me the most is when the waves get really big. And that's the highest point of pushing myself in anything in my life is when the waves get really big and you have that fear and anxiety and nervous energy and being able to control your body and have it do what you want it to do when you need it to do it.
When that fear and anxiety is you know, kind of swelling up inside you, it can be almost overwhelming. You have to fight being overwhelmed, right?
Yeah, it can be very overwhelming, and it's easy to let that distract you. But I feel like a big part of what's so special about surfing big waves is the narrowed-in focus it requires from you.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that you're thinking about drifts away immediately when one of those waves stands up in front of you.
Sure.
And you're not focused on your groceries or your bills or anything like that. It all is just narrowed into 3 feet in front of you and dealing with whatever you're feeling under your feet as you're riding the wave.
People who pursue those kind of activities, be it, you know, in mountain climbing or big wave surfing, describe it as a very sort of a pure consciousness. As you say, consciousness with nothing else in your mind has nothing else in it, right?
Yeah, and I feel that's exactly it. There's no other time in my life that I have complete focus on one single thing. No matter what, I find distractions easy and I get, you know, pulled away to certain things very, very easily. And that's one thing in my life where everything is about the happening right now.
That must affect the rest of your life in some...
Yeah, and it has helped me learn a lot about patience and a good understanding of how important it is to be focused on what it is you're doing right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Like as we're speaking now, be engaged in this conversation and not think about other things. So it's been a long process, I'm learning.
It's a long process for everybody, I think, Ian, because, you know, very, very rarely do we have that kind of focus, no matter how hard we're trying. In a way, though, the enormous power of the energy doesn't give you a lot of choice, does it?
No, and that's it. It requires every detail and every nuance of your attention to the details in it, and it takes everything you have in you to really focus on those little points, and that's why I think it's such a heightened feeling. You know, I don't have a big sense of hearing when I'm riding the waves, and a lot of that is because I think all my other senses are firing at such a high level that all those other little things kind of drift away.
Does time slow down?
I'm definitely in a slower place, and it does seem to move a little bit it feels like everything is silent as soon as I stand up on a wave, and then immediately when I kick out of the wave, if I make it or I fall, then all the volume and everything comes back in. So I haven't really figured out what it is that makes that silence happen when you take off, but it is there.
I wonder if it's just because in those seconds you don't need your hearing as much as you need your other senses.
I mean, as soon as you realize someone's not behind you and you don't need to be paying attention to who's deeper than you, then it's almost like an immediate shut off and your hearing drifts away and that's probably exactly what it is. Everything else is so heightened that your body is reacting to not needing that as a necessity.
One of the things that amazes me about surfers is their ability to read the waves, read where waves are going. You know, a civilian and a surfer will look at the same thing and see, you know, the surfer will see all this detail that no non-surfer would even know was there, right?
Yeah, and that's part of growing up in the ocean and putting your eyes on the water every single day. And that's really similar to someone that is a professional snowboarder or someone that understands mountains really well. Like the way I would look at a mountain, it just looks like a big, beautiful hill.
Sure.
And they look at it like a canvas. They see all these different lines they can approach down the mountain. They see different ways of riding it. They see different textures in the snow. And it's the same for us as surfers. We see the current line. We see the texture. We see the wind. We see if the tide is high, low, or medium. And you see if the swell is rising, declining, how long the interval is, almost in milliseconds.
There's a lot of time spent getting yourself ready to be able to react that way. And how do you, you know, during the times when the waves aren't coming in like that, there are all kinds of ways to prepare, but what are they?
Yeah, that's changed a lot for me over the last few years. A lot of my focus has moved into preparation, so I feel fit and healthy through the duration of winter rather than just one specific day.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is a block I do prior to winter, a training block that's about 6 to 8 weeks before November 1st.
Mm-hmm.
And that just includes, you know, two hours in the gym. And prior to that, I do an hour and a half of surfing to 2 hours, depending on the waves. And if the waves are really good, I'll put a lot more time in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So it usually goes that hour and a half in the gym, then 2 hours in the water, and then an hour and a half on a bike, and then another surf in the evening. And that's an average day in that training block for me. And I'll do that 6 days a week. And then on the seventh day, it's just surfing all day. And that helps rev me up for winter.
You never really have a rest day then.
Well, my rest day is just kind of surfing all day. And if the waves are really good at any point during that training block, then the time on the gym goes away and the time on the bike goes away. And I'll do 3 or 4 sessions surfing. And then as winter starts to gear up, then I feel a lot more comfortable. I feel a lot more confident. I've had a lot of time on the board. And I don't know, I just feel like if I can take any detail and make myself feel a little bit more comfortable in that super uncomfortable world when the waves are big, then it's worth it for me, because I don't have anything in my head that I'm second-guessing myself. And for me personally, I know, okay, I've put in all the work I can to be in a place to be able to push myself if an opportunity arises.
Sounds like there are lessons to be learned from this that apply to a lot of different things.
Yeah, I've learned a lot, and the ocean is a never-ending book that we learn from every single surf.
Yeah, and it'll always be more powerful than you are, right?
It will always be.
Thanks so much for coming in.
No worries. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
My pleasure. Ian Walsh is a big wave surfer who's the subject of the new film Distance Between Dreams, which debuts online today and will have a premiere showing at Turtle Bay Resort this evening. The movie starts at 8 p.m.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Beth Ann, you talked to the chair of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission earlier in the show, and I hope people still understand that term, civil rights, in terms of the enormous resonance it has in our American history.
Do you think they don't?
Yes, I do think they don't. I think a lot of the fervor of the so-called civil rights era of the 60s, I mean, we remember Dr. King, we remember Selma, we remember all those flashpoints of the movement back in the day, and that passion, you know, changed our society for good. But have we held on to it is the question that kind of goes through my mind.
As you move away from it generationally, it's tougher to hang on to,
yeah.
Which is the reason that we always hear we have to look at it more carefully and understand how hard fought that was.
That's right.
Well, we're going to take a look at some of those things as we come into next week, talking about Pearl Harbor and the 75th anniversary and some stories you probably haven't heard. So we hope you'll plan to be with all of us then on Hawaii Public Radio. Meanwhile, also coming next week, we're going to take a look at the 21st Century Care Act.
And we'll
Cures
have some,
Act, sorry about that.
We'll have some musical visitors to celebrate the holiday season.
And meanwhile, you can be in touch with us anytime you like on our talk back line. That number is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you like Facebook, we're there at Hawaii Conversation. That's our page. Or you can tweet us at HI Conversation or say hello to me at BKOZHPR.
And if you want to hear today's show again, you can hear it on our conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme is written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Monday when we pick up the conversation. Have a good weekend.